We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Some of America's most joyous and exuberant music and film was created during the worst economic and social period in our history. However, our guest for this hour, Morris Dickstein, says that the musicals and the movies of the 30s provided more for the people of the time than mere entertainment. He says they also gave people hope that things would one day be better. This morning we'll be talking about a newly published book. The title is Dancing in the Dark, A Cultural History of the Great Depression. And we'll be looking at both sides of 1930s culture, both the social criticism and the escapism, two sides that our guest says really weren't that different. Our guest, Morris Dickstein, is Distinguished Professor of English and Theater at the City University of New York Graduate Center. He is the author of the book Gates of Eden, which is about the 1960s, and also Leopards in the Temple. He is joining us this morning by telephone. Professor Dickstein, hello.
Hi.
I'm good. Thank you. And yourself?
Excellent.
Thank you for joining us
today.
Glad
to be here.
We appreciate it. Well, you know, I think that, as you point out, that people, I think, when they look at the culture of the 30s, tend probably to see really two broad categories. That is, on one side, the social and political commentary that was very much about confronting reality, and on the other, escapist entertainment that was not. And I think you raise an interesting question. That is, you know, you say, let us say, for example, take Grapes of Wrath. Here we have a period that produced this great novel by Steinbeck about the social and economic dislocations that occurred because of what was going on. So here we have a period that gave us the Grapes of Wrath, but it also gave us Bringing Up Baby, the screwball comedy with Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn. And one might say, well, I can understand how this period would produce one or the other, but how could it have produced both?
Well, first of all, the Depression was very pervasive in American culture, and one of the things that struck me when we were having the discussion of the stimulus bill in the spring was how much Hollywood and other arts in the 30s had functioned as a kind of stimulus program alongside that of the New Deal. I think this is related to the fact that there's also a depression with a small d in the 1930s, that people were genuinely depressed by the situation that they found themselves in. There was a great erosion of confidence of the kind that we saw last fall in the United States, where the credit markets froze up and people stopped lending and people stopped buying very suddenly. Just as President Obama saw the need to kind of stimulate and raise confidence, I think so both the government and the arts in the 30s saw that similar need to bolster confidence and morale, and it had some of that function. Now, The Grapes of Wrath, was a very exciting story in a way, and it was not exactly about the crisis as the crisis was happening. The Dust Bowl situation had passed a little by the time the book came out. It's rather late in the 40s that it came out. And although it pricked the conscience of America, it was not the most immediate concern at the time. So I think there's a little bit of an overlap between the so-called escapist work and the social criticism that we also associate with the Depression. Hmm.
So just to go back to your early point, when you talk about Hollywood being seen as in some ways, like the stimulus efforts of today, what you're talking about is something that would be an emotional or psychological stimulus, not that it would be an economic one.
Yeah, well, the thing about, you mentioned Bringing Up Baby. The thing about that, of course, and so many other screwball comedies, is the incredible speed. You know, the director, Howard Hawks, had perfected this idea of people speaking to each other, not as on the stage where they wait till the other person finished their speech, but sort of biting off the ends of each other's dialogue. And that incredible rapidity gives a huge charge of energy to these works. Also, the behavior of the kind of Daffy Rich in these movies. And I see that as bringing a terrific charge of energy into the culture of the 30s, very much like the jazz and swing music of the big bands of the period, or the Art Deco design, which is also very streamlined, very very futuristic. It's a kind of tremendous thrust of forward motion that you get in a lot of these arts at a time when the country was caught in a sort of stasis. The country was caught in stagnation, and everyone saw their charge as to get the country moving again, and this was happening on a lot of different fronts.
And I like that idea that and as I think about it, it seems a stronger and stronger point that if you look at everything from the design of the period to architecture to all the movies that had dancing in them and this kind of momentum and storytelling that you see in a lot of movies, what your point you make is that what you see is a great enthusiasm for movement. And I suppose at some level what that says is, all right, things are bad now, but we're not standing still. That there is this idea that there is a forward momentum, and I suppose it buried in that is the idea that as we move forward, things just have to get better.
Well, you see, at the one extreme, we have all the great photography of the 30s, and that really reflects the static quality of the situation. You know, famous photographs like Dorothea Lange's Migrant Mother or the pictures that Walker Evans took of the sharecroppers in the South. These are people who are pinned in a situation they can't get out of. You see the furrowed brows. You see they're very static compositions. On the other hand, if you against photography, we have the choreography: Busby Berkeley, Fred Astaire, all that not only energy but kind of grace of movement, something that was missing from people's lives during this rather drab and static period. And it was a kind of supplement to people's lives, a charge. Not only of energy, but of elegance that was really psychological, almost more than it was physical or cultural. Mm.
So, is there some way you think that if you take those things and you set them side by side, that is, a lot of the journalistic work that was done that documented poverty in America and serious fiction that did the same thing. If you set that aside, the kind of popular entertainments that we're talking about that would seem on the face of them to be much less serious, not to have a serious bone in their bodies, that somehow those two things are more alike than we would seem. That seems to be an argument that you're making.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's actually, in the so-called escapist work, there's a surprising amount of stuff about the Depression. I mean, if you look at the early Busby Berkeley movies like 42nd Street or the Gold Diggers of 1933, two very successful movies of 1933, it's all about showgirls who are starving, who are out of work, who are desperate for a job. And every other line is a wisecrack about the Depression. On the other hand, you can't gainsay the tremendous documentary impulse that existed in the 1930s. I mean, artists of all kinds, photographers, writers, and so on, were simply fascinated by what their fellow countrymen were going through. In the 20s, a lot of them had gone off to Paris to be part of the avant-garde. In the 30s, they came home and were struck by the heroism of ordinary Americans simply trying to get by. And they wanted to help them by documenting their condition and to have other Americans understand what some of their fellow citizens were going through. And that's the wonderful thing about the photography and some of the best of the fiction.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, let me reintroduce, is Morris Dickstein. He is a professor he's distinguished professor of English and theater at the City University of New York Graduate Center. He has also authored a number of books. One is A Cultural History of the 60s. That's Gates of Eden. That was named as one of the year's best books by the New York Times Book Review in 1978. He's also written the book Leopards in the Temple, A Social History of Post-War American Fiction. And his newest book, it's just out now, it's Dancing in the Dark. The subtitle is A Cultural History of the Great Depression. It's published by W.W. Norton and is just out now. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, people of the appropriate age will recognize the title of the book as a song, Dancing in the Dark. Why did you pick that? What sort of images do you like that suggests that gives you a kind of a jumping off point.
Well, you know, I had known that song for a long time. It's a 1931 song by Dietz and Schwartz, and hadn't really paid much attention to it. And rather late in the process of finishing the book, I listened to Bing Crosby's version of that song very closely, because I was writing a section on Bing Crosby, who was one of the most popular entertainers in the 30s on radio and movies and so on. And I was struck by how he had picked up some of the really darker shadings of that. You have two people dancing, but they're surrounded by a great darkness that could be almost anything. It could be just the darkness of the ballroom. It could be the darkness of the life itself. It could be the darkness of the Depression. It talks about how we're here dancing, and then we're gone. And the conclusion of the song is, well, let's face the music together. And this struck me as such an important Depression motif. First of all, the mixture of energy, of movement, of being simply of solidarity, of being together, whether romantic or communal and so on. At the same time, you were surrounded by these troubles, and this solidarity enables you to face the music together. I couldn't help but interpret that as both the story of my book and the story of the Depression culture as a whole, and so it was like a godsend to me.
Yeah. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and again, our guest this morning is Morris Dickstein, and we're talking about his new book, Dancing in the Dark. It is a cultural history of the Great Depression. We have a caller to talk with, someone who is listening in Champaign, so let's do that. Line number one right here. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, I'd like to make an observation, which, of course, is probably not terribly unique. A cultural history like yours tends to be very selective, and while you're talking about one aspect of the culture of the 1930s, the 1930s was also the era of the great triumph of high modernism in America. While all this was going on, you've been talking about in art, music, and literature, the great modernism was also being practiced and absorbed and introduced into American culture. And, of course, high modernism rejects all the values of tradition, et cetera, that many of the Depression artists are promulgating. So this is the other side of what's going on in American culture of the 30s. So how would you reconcile high modernism and all its anti-traditional values with the, quote, Depression culture that you're talking about? Thank you.
All right.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think most people, myself included, think of the triumph of high modernism as being mainly in the 1920s and then again after the war, the 1920s with, you know, poets like Wallace Stevens, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, you know, novelists like Faulkner and Fitzgerald and Hemingway. I think most people associate the 1930s, because of the social crisis, with a return to realism and naturalism, both in the visual arts and painting, a lot of the murals and so on, and also in fiction. I think one of the unusual things about my book is that I try to show how, pretty much as you say, that modernism remained a very important subcurrent, a kind of counter theme of the 1930s. I talk about the Faulkner works, especially As I Lay Dying. I talk about the great unread but later discovered novel by Henry Roth, very much call it Sleep, very much influenced by Joyce and T.S. Eliot. I talk about one of the greatest of the sharecropper books, you know, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men by Walker Evans and James Agee. Agee very much influenced by Faulkner's style. And so the truth is that, especially in the first long section of my book about poverty, I deal very closely with modernism as an important counter theme of the 30s. But I wouldn't go so far as you would to say that it was the major current of the 30s. I think it was more a subterranean influence that came through from the 1920s.
All right. Again, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that certainly some of the most enduring images to come from the Depression are the kinds of documentary-style photographs that you're talking about. And people, while they might not immediately recognize the names of the photographers, I'm sure that people are familiar with the pictures and how much they have put a kind of a stamp on the way that we think about it, particularly for all of those of us who didn't live through that. What it seems to be, I think, interesting is that while no one would have said that poverty didn't exist in America before the Depression, that somehow that the crash, and then the efforts of people to document what it meant for a lot of Americans brought the problem, the reality of poverty, to the attention of people to a degree and extent that it hadn't before.
Well, one interesting feature is that just as we have historical novels like Gone with the Wind that are really set at earlier periods, but about social catastrophe and social crisis and trying to survive them, and we can see, certainly I can see, how they're related to the Depression. We even have novels about poverty that are set in an earlier period, but are very much on the agenda of the 30s. The first successful, you might say, social consciousness novel of the 30s was a book by a communist, Michael Gold, called Jews Without Money. It went through about 11 printings in the first year it appeared in 1930, and this was about growing up at the turn of the century in the Jewish ghetto of the Lower East Side. And it is a book about poverty, about the culture of poverty before that term was used. And I think this helped set an agenda for the so-called proletarian novelists of the 1930s, even though it was not yet about the 1930s. Now, when you talk about poverty, we inevitably think about the great photographers. And if I don't want to do this, but if I had to single out probably the single most outstanding artistic legacy of the 1930s, I'd have to say it was those documentary photographers, Walker Evans, Margaret Burke White, Dorothea Lange, and so on, because their images have become so much a part of our national heritage. They have really, I think they were originally done to inform Americans about what was happening then, about what their fellow Americans were going through. But they were done with such taste. They allowed, they turned their subjects not into merely victims, but they allowed them such dignity that they have become just a permanent part of our understanding, not simply of the 30s, but of the human condition. And so, I completely agree with you.
Yeah, we now, when we look at them, we see them as an important kind of window on the past. How did people of the time see them?
Well, they were a bit controversial. The government sponsored a lot of this work. Some of it was done privately, like, Life magazine came into existence in 1936, and both Life and Fortune, the loose magazines, however, did not really want to get into the kind of darkest side of the Depression. They had a kind of upbeat, optimistic, look to them. But Margaret Burke White was the star photographer for Life magazine, and she, on her own, with a man who later became her husband, the novelist Erskine Caldwell, went to the South in the summer of 36 and 37, and they took these pictures that Life refused to publish, but became a book called You Have Seen Their Faces. And I think that this was a book that was very widely read. It was in the coffee table. It was a coffee table book in, I think, every progressive household in America. What impact it had, I think it helped bolster support for the New Deal programs. The sense that there was a real agricultural crisis, that even in the rural world, where you could presumably raise crops for your own food, that even there was starvation and poverty, certainly helped forward a lot of the New Deal programs on the agricultural side and many other reform programs as well. So they did have a real impact.
For a lot of people, you'd have to say that the Depression was the great leveler, and that it affected people across lines of race and ethnicity. It affected people in urban areas. It affected people in rural areas. How did, in particular, the kind of depictions that we've been talking about of what was happening to people in their lives, how did that affect the way Americans thought about, themselves, each other, the nation, in terms of its diversity?
Well, on the one hand, a great deal of diversity came into 30s culture. I mean, this was the first period when Italian-Americans, Jews, blacks came directly into the culture, into the mainstream of the culture. The popular big band music, for example, was very much black-influenced. It was the first and only time that jazz has really been popular music in America. A lot of other ethnic groups produced many important artists. On the other hand, race was a kind of secondary issue in the 1930s. Part of it was a problem that faced FDR in the New Deal. His programs, the passage of his programs, the Democratic majorities in Congress, depended very heavily on Southern Democratic support, and you could call that Southern racist support. So he really had to mostly avoid programs that were directly racially oriented. On the other hand, the anti-poverty programs that were very important, the relief programs, did, by its very nature, help a lot of black people who were often at the lowest end of the economic scale. And so, on the one hand, it was a very multicultural culture, but it did not discover the racial issues the way the post-war years did, because they were not really on the political or even on the cultural agenda yet.
Mm. One of the things that I think that you see in you see it in novels and you see it in film is you see characters that perhaps mostly because of the force of circumstance, but maybe also it had something to do with their characters, turned bad. And it seems that though what they do, their antisocial behavior, their violent behavior, seems to be in some way the only sort of said this is it's almost the only thing they can do, the only expression that they have, the only possibility that they have. And I wonder, you know, how you think about that and people and how people thought about it at the time. That some of these stories have these really dark characters at the center, people who face tragic, you know, who have faced tragic ends.
Well, the gangster films are a perfect example.
That's what I'm thinking of, and also those characters that we all remember, played by guys like Jimmy Cagney and Eddie Robinson.
Right. I mean, my interpretation of that is that people were fascinated by characters who somehow could battle circumstances, who, however ruthlessly, could get themselves up from the gutter, sitting on top of the world, even though ultimately these stories were tragic and they ended up back in the gutter at the end. And this was a period where people felt they had very little control over their lives, very little of what we sometimes call agency, power over their lives. And so they admired and identified with these charismatic characters who seemed to be able to take control of circumstances. These were essentially success stories, or you might say success and failure stories. And, you know, the country, the moral authorities of the country were very worried about this. After a couple of years of successful gangster films, they really cracked down. Even during the period from 1930 to 32, which was the heyday of the gangster film, they had to put these disclaimer labels at the beginning saying, you know, this character is not to be identified with. This is just a documentation of one of the social and criminal problems of our time and so on. But there's no question that people did identify with these characters who took the world in their hands and ran roughshod over everyone around them, something that they themselves were unable to do.
Mm. Were there people who said that people who were doing social commentary from whatever perspective looked at that kind of entertainment and said, look, these kinds of characters are just not constructive. This is not the kind of role model we want for Americans. This isn't the kind of stories that we should be telling, that somehow we should be telling stories that had more moral uplift.
Right. Well, there was in the mid-30s, there was a tremendous crackdown by the guardians of morality. The period, for example, in Hollywood between 1930 to 1934, there was a production code that had certain guidelines for stories, but it was pretty much ignored. And in 1934, suddenly they began to enforce it. And all of the prohibitions that we associate with the Hollywood movies of the next 30 years, you couldn't even show a married couple in a double bed. That had to be twin beds. You couldn't have anyone who behaved badly succeed at the end. You couldn't show even the faintest intimation of a sexual situation. All these things were done between 30 and 34, and then suddenly forbidden by this new regime that was concerned about the kinds of characters that people were identifying with and the kinds of situations that were being depicted.
Hmm. Our guest, let me just very quickly introduce again. We're just a little bit past our midpoint. Our guest is Morris Dickstein. He is a distinguished professor of English and also of theater. This is at City University of New York Graduate Center. He is the author of the book Gates of Eden, which is a cultural history of the 60s, also Leopards in the Temple, that's a social history of post-war American fiction, and he is the author of a newly published book that is all about the cultural history of the Great Depression, and the title of that book is Dancing in the Dark, and it's published by W.W. Norton. That's just out. Questions certainly are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think that it's interesting, while at the same time that people were looking at the kind of stories that we were just talking about, these kind of dark stories about these tragic characters that challenge the mores of society and come to a bad end, that also people were enjoying a very different kind of story about people who were on the other end of the socioeconomic scale, maybe people who didn't really exist anymore, but who were people of leisure and also were just silly. Silly, frivolous, didn't really contribute much of anything to society, ineffectual people who were in one way or another, either literally or figuratively, always seemed to be falling on their faces. People certainly enjoyed those movies, and we're still watching them and enjoying them. How now? What's the sort of connection between the man who says, "I'm top of the world, Ma," and then blows himself up, and the kind of these sort of giddy, silly people of leisure that we see in these other kinds of movies?
Well, people love, this is one of the amazing things about the Depression, people love these stories about the very rich. You get them in wonderful screwball comedies like My Man Godfrey or It Happened One Night, or you get them in the Fred Astaire or Ginger Rogers movies that are closely related to the screwball comedies. I think there are a couple of reasons. One of them, as you said, these characters are very silly. On the one hand, they had, because of their money, because of their fabulous wealth, they had a leisure and freedom that people didn't have in the Depression. And so people identified with their freedom to be silly. At the same time, people could feel superior to them. They could feel these characters are like children. They need, their butler, William Powell, to come along in My Man Godfrey and sort out their lives, which are just about to crash and burn. And so they could feel that, at the same time, identifying with the good facets of these people's lives, their freedom, their money, their general daffiness, and at the same time, they could think, we're not very well off, but we're not as bad off as these people are. And so, and at the same time, of course, that freedom that these rich people had in their lives created the possibility for the kind of energy that I was talking about before, the energy that was such a shot in the arm to the audience during the Depression that provided such excitement in an otherwise rather drab and dingy era.
Mm-hmm. I guess it does. You have to look at those characters and you have to say that all of the advantages that they're money brought them, it didn't seem to give them much in the way of common sense, and maybe that's one way that your average person could see that they were better off.
Well, one thing people enjoyed about them, I mentioned the censorship that cracked down in 1934, and that's just about exactly when screwball comedy began with It Happened One Night and other movies of 1934. And I think one of the things the people enjoyed about these movies is the cat and mouse game that they played with the censorship. If you look at a wonderful movie like Capra's It Happened One Night, almost everything in the movie is about sex. There's a double entendre in every line. The same is true of Bringing Up Baby. At the same time, there's nothing explicitly sexual or erotic about it. This is true of other films like The Awful Truth and so on. So in Bringing Up Baby, you have these leopards that are really about the id and so on. So this was a way... This was a wonderfully oblique way that Hollywood filmmakers and actors and actresses had of dealing with the banned subjects like sexuality that the guardians of morality had tried to exercise.
Aside from, for the people who were making movies, aside from the fact that they were thinking about making a living for everybody who was involved and selling tickets being successful, did they think about what else they were doing? Did they, for example, think that they were providing escapist entertainment? Did they somehow think that what they were doing maybe even provided something more than that? Or were they just thinking that, well, you know, we got to make a good movie here because we got to get people into the seats because we want to sell tickets because we all need to make a living?
Well, you know, it was different for different studios. You know, the 30s was the period when filmmaking really became an industrial process, and they began to develop the real assembly line. Each studio had developed its own individual style, its own stable of stars, and kind of assembly line process to churn out very large numbers of movies each year. Now, as an industry, of course, they were subject to the downturns of other industries, and a lot of studios in the early 30s became close to bankruptcy, and some of them actually did become bankrupt. So what they were thinking of mainly was lowering costs, selling tickets, and surviving as an industry. On the other hand, they did have a relationship to the political environment. For example, Jack Warner of Warner Brothers was pretty close to FDR, and he sometimes would call their very topical films, you know, a New Deal in entertainment. He really tried to get in lockstep with the New Deal and really... Warner Brothers was of course the studio that made the most socially conscious movies, things like, you know, Wild Boys of the Road or I'm a Fugitive from a Chain Gang or Heroes for Sale, and he felt that he was helping, you might say, the war effort against the Depression. Other studios like MGM were more concerned with biographies and trying to create a kind of upholstered project that would be have an aura of quality that simply would make their reputation in a different way. And so, you know, it varies a great deal.
Certainly one of the goals of the New Deal was to get people working. And one, among the groups of people they were interested in employing were writers and artists.
Right.
And it's very, very interesting that they would, you know, not in addition to the fact that they would want to get people out there building roads and doing everything that they could to try to improve the country's infrastructure and to give, you know, put at least a few dollars in people's pockets. They also would have thought about the fact that, you know, we've got playwrights and poets and journalists and photographers and painters and all of these people, and we ought to do something to get them to work too. And, you know, one wonders whether, in fact, a lot of the art that we saw come out of this period, whether it would have happened had it not been for that kind of federal support.
Well, you know, this is the WPA and the murals sponsored by the Treasury Department. The WPA was an actual relief project that came into existence because one of his advisors said to Roosevelt, you know, artists have got to eat too. And so you have a writer's project, a theater project, a music project, and so on. On the other hand, you have a kind of similar employment project, you might say, on some of the Hollywood movies. You take Busby Berkeley with his huge chorus lines and so on. You know, the starving showgirls are part of the subject of the movie, but Berkeley was a perfectionist, and he would do take after take with these large, large groups of actors and extras and so on. And you look at the movie and you think of how many people he was keeping employed just making this movie. So in a way, the making of the movie and the themes of the movie really relate to each other rather closely, and they're both really very Depression-oriented, and I see them as quite parallel to the unique, you know, government-sponsored art.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting to set those two things aside one another and say that in many ways that they were so much alike. And I guess in the past I wouldn't really have thought about Busby Berkeley and the New Deal as being so closely related.
Well, you know, the early Busby Berkeley films like 42nd Street and Gold Diggers were, you know, one of them, I forget which of the two it was actually timed for Roosevelt's inauguration in 1933. Jack Warner commissioned a train traveling all through the country from California to Washington, D.C., with hundreds of promotional stops along the way, and it was supposed to arrive just at exactly the time of Roosevelt's inauguration, as if the movie and the new president were part of really the same transformation of American culture. It was uncanny.
And we do, and maybe it seems hard for us to relate to now, but I suppose that all of it did have this, you know, kids, if we all pull together, we can all succeed, this let's put on a show kind of thing. It very much is the kind of spirit that I'm sure that the government, that the Roosevelt administration, was really trying to get people to get into.
Well, that's a terrific point. It's a very important point also because, you know, if you look at serious work, you know, so-called serious work like the novel or the film of The Grapes of Wrath, and you look for what the underlying message is, the message is, you know, individual families feel stricken on their own, but when they discover that other families are in the same boat, they discover that if they sort of pool their resources, if they work together, they may have a chance of surviving that they wouldn't have on their own. And that's so close to the show business motif of let's put on our show and let's get together, even to the getting together theme of romantic stories like the Astaire Rogers movies. One of the deepest currents in American history and American thought has always been individualism, self-reliance, and so on. And yet it was very different in the 30s. This is one of the few periods when the idea of solidarity or community or the collective really predominated over the emphasis on the individual, and you see it everywhere in the period.
And that really, I like that because that gets us back to Dancing in the Dark. That really is the point that you're making, that here, for example, if you look at so many of those movies that the two of them made, that Fred and Ginger made, you see these characters that spend most of the movie just butting heads and misunderstanding one another and arguing with each other. And the only time that we get that, when the harmony comes, when with this poetry in motion is created, is when the two come together and all that other stuff falls away.
Exactly. They spend most of the movie misunderstanding each other, getting angry at each other. But that's simply in the world of just talking. But in the world of music, the world of dance, suddenly they're beautifully harmonious. And I think, you know, I don't want to give it a political interpretation, but it's so strongly parallel to so many other cultural themes of the 30s that go from, you might say, competition and individuality to solidarity, romance, togetherness, helping each other. You might say interdependency. Mm-hmm. It's a horrible word to apply to Astaire and Rogers, but it's not totally inappropriate.
And that would have been a great departure from the kinds of themes in culture that you would have seen, say, in the 20s?
Yeah, well, I think individuality and especially individual psychology were much more important in the 20s. Psychology becomes less important in the 30s because the social situation takes predominance over over introspection and the musings and the fate of the individual. And that's also a rarity in American cultural history. The shift from individual psychology and you might say the inwardness of individual characters toward the solidarity and the relationship of characters to each other, that's really the predominant motif of the 30s.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Morris Tickstein. He is a distinguished professor of English and theater at the City University of New York Graduate Center. And we are talking about some of what you will find in his recently published book, Dancing in the Dark. It's a cultural history of the Great Depression, and it is published by W.W. Norton. Questions are certainly welcome. We have about maybe 10 minutes left. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about in your preface to the book, you talk about the fact that at one point you weren't really quite sure about this particular project that is looking at the culture of the 30s. And although you said, you write here that you've often been drawn to periods when art and social crisis come together. And certainly I think you could say that that was true of the 60s, the subject of one of your earlier books. And you go on in this particular section to say, well, you were wondering, well, was the 30s and the kind of issues raised too much like the 60s? So, in essentially, you'd be dealing with the same issues. And that interested me and prompted me to ask the question, well, are there some ways, do you think, that in fact what was happening in the 60s was much like what had happened in the 30s?
Well, I finally decided that they were very different. They certainly were different from me because I lived through the 60s. Mm. And I had personal memories, which I didn't have, of the 30s. They were different also because, strangely, the cultural crises of the 60s were related to prosperity. It was a very prosperous period. And in a sense, the students of the 60s had the leisure to protest, which at other times, including today, they don't or didn't have. In the 30s, however, it was not issues related to prosperity or war like the war in Vietnam, but issues having to do with poverty, with even people who weren't poor who had jobs, with fear for the future. I mentioned in the book that my father, who had a steady but low-paying job all through the 30s, told me once that each Friday when he picked up his paycheck, he somehow expected to find a pink slip with the paycheck laying him off. And so that gnawing anxiety affected even people who were surviving, who were employed, and so on. The thing about social crisis is that we usually think that they marginalize the arts, that if you're in a social crisis, you have no time to sit down and be creative, that the only effect that it could have on the arts is a bad effect, that it makes the arts too topical, too concerned with immediate issues. I discovered in the course of working on both these books that the opposite was true, that social crisis can be one of the most stimulating things to an artist, and in a very interesting way, because it stimulates the artist to get out of his or her own head and to look around at what's happening to other people, to look around at the society. If there was one motif I would say was central to the 1930s, I would say this whole looking around at how your fellow citizens were doing. This was a period when artists did get out of their own heads, did get out of their own personal concerns to see what other people were doing, how other people were suffering and surviving. And so it was stimulating to the arts, but not arts that were typical of art in America.
Mm. I've also read that in advance of the book coming out, you were talking about some of the themes in the book, talking about the arts of the Depression, and I'm sure no surprise, many people said to you, they asked you about parallels between that time and this time, and asked questions about, particularly, I guess, about how you think that for people who are living through this economic downturn, whether it will leave a mark on them and the way that they think in the way that the Depression did for people who lived through that.
Well, I think it's hard to predict because, first of all, this great recession that we're having now luckily has not gone as deep or pervasive as the, we have 10% unemployment. In 1933, there was 25% unemployment. Mm. That's a terrific difference. So it's hard to say, and it's hard also to predict how this will happen. But I think certainly people will think twice before going off on spending sprees the way they did, in the 1990s or the early part of this decade. I know that from my parents and other people of the Depression generation, I know that the anxiety, the fear, the sense of instability, the need for security was a lifelong thing for them, that the Depression marked their psyches forever. And I don't know whether the current recession will have the same impact on the younger generation today. I mean, people graduating from college now or people looking for jobs, they're facing a somewhat bleak situation, nothing like what they would have faced 5 years ago. And I doubt that even 10 years from now, when things have changed, they're going to be so happy living on credit card debt and things like that, things that were almost second nature in the 1990s. So I think it will be an impact. I don't know what the impact on the arts will be. That's harder to predict because the arts take a while to assimilate a social situation, and we haven't really seen much evidence yet of how this current crisis will be assimilated.
Mm-hmm. In the period when the Depression starts to wane and the economy starts to pick up, and I'm sure that a lot of people would argue that the thing that really did it was World War II and the need of the country to gear up to fight that war. The major focus would have changed, or at least that the big challenge would have changed, and that people would have been thinking about now this other thing that the nation has to get together and do as a nation. When you get to that sort of the end of the period that you're looking at here, how did things start to change there in terms of the arts and popular entertainment?
Well, things certainly looked up at the end of the 30s, and one of the problems with the book I mentioned before, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, about three sharecropper families, it came out in 1941 and it was just too late. People weren't that interested anymore. It's true that the New Deal didn't fully end the war, really, end the Depression. It was really World War II and the full production of World War II. But, you know, it's just as the Depression had made a very, very sudden change of the country's morale and temperament in 1930, 31, things looked very different from the 20s. So I think by 1940, 1941, the Depression mentality had largely passed. And so when people went to see The Grapes of Wrath or read the novel, it was almost already a historical situation for them, something that they were very moved by, but not something that was on their immediate agenda. It's true that there were some reverses along the way. There was a big recession in 1937. But by and large, there was a much more optimism between 1937 and 1941, even though the Depression had not fully ended.
I guess I would imagine that people they would come to a book like that, or they would come to a film like that, and they might say, having lived through it, they might say, you know, I lived through it. I don't want to go there again. Was there any sort of rejection of those sorts of themes?
Oh, definitely. That was true certainly by the mid-40s, the late 40s, and so on. Nobody wanted to hear anything about the Depression. That was considered ancient history. No, they didn't want to hear about that at all. And this left a lot of Depression artists and writers really high and dry unless they could readapt to a new situation, first of war, then of post-war prosperity. Some of them adapted very well. Some of them didn't. I mean, John Steinbeck never wrote a book anything like the Depression novels that he'd written, and this was true of many other artists. There was such a sea change between the Depression and the 1940s that many, many successful writers and artists simply could not adapt, or they never did anything remotely as good as what they'd done before.
Mm. So just as a way of finishing up, I guess a general question, you can talk about how it is that this is the subject of the Depression, as I sort of said in the beginning. When we think about that, well, we think about economic policy. We think about what the government response was. We approach that in a very, again, sort of journalistic and documentary sort of way. What advantage does it give us, whether we're talking about that time or any other time, to look at the popular culture of the time?
Because it takes us really inside the mind of the period. The thing about the popular culture is that it's about people and their relationship. It's about their psyches. It's about their deepest fears about the world and the deepest joys that they can take, even in a terrible situation. So if I had more nerve, I would have called this the inner history of the Great Depression, the inner history, because culture is what gives us the inward lives of people, not just the documentation of the surface of their lives. And so I felt that I had a very privileged access to what was going on in the mind of the Depression and not simply in the social world of the Depression.
Well, if people who are listening would like to read more, they should look for the book Dancing in the Dark, A Cultural History of the Great Depression. It is published by W.W. Norton by our guest, Morris Dickstein, a distinguished professor of English and theater at the City University of New York Graduate Center. His other books include The Gates of Eden, which is a cultural history of the 1960s, and also Leopards in the Temple, a social history of post-war American fiction. Professor Dickstein, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.